Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Weekly, a new podcast show in which we recap the week on Eurogamer for you. We know you're busy, so don't worry, we've got your back. In half an hour, we'll whisk through the features and reviews, news and videos that stood out on the site this week. Joining me today is Eurogamer Editor-in-Chief Martin Robinson. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
And Features Editor Christian Donlan.
Hello. Hello.
It's lovely to have you on the show with us. What have your highlights been this week, in games or otherwise?
Oh my God, have there been any highlights? It's been one of those weeks. No, some some good stuff must have happened. There's been some good games. I know we spoke about it briefly last week, but Songs of Conquest, which I picked up off the back of your piece this week, which
have
is just wonderful. I've attempted to play it on the Steam Deck and then realised it doesn't work very well on the Steam Deck because I can't figure out how to right-click on the Steam Deck, right-click a mouse on the Steam Deck yet. But this is just, that's not a slight on the game itself. That's a slight on me just being really stupid and not understanding how fundamentally PC games work, especially on Steam Deck.
But on our site, a lot of our criticism ends up with saying, that's not a slight on the game, but that's a slight on me. We end up sort of critiquing ourselves more than the games a lot of the time, and rightly so.
I love the feedback in that article. Lots of people saying, you had me at Heroes of Might and Magic. Clearly, there's a lot of dormant love for that series, which is bubbling up. So the Songs of Conquest team have nailed it by the looks of things.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the menu screen and the opening map of that, and I need to spend some more time with it over the weekend, but it looks wonderful.
The menu screen is lovely. Menu screens are that first impression in games that really get you and kind of settle you for what's coming. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's a really good menu, and I've been playing, I can say it now actually, because the embargo is not lifting for another hour and a half, but this will be out after that. I've been playing Multiversus.
How is it?
I went in fully expecting to basically, not obviously it's bad to go in with assumptions, and I'm a professional, so I wouldn't do that at all. But I might have gone in thinking, oh my God, what is this? It's just going to be really funny to go and see what an absolute state this thing is, because it's such a bizarre concept and quite a grim concept as well.
So
I
it's
guess.
Like Smash Brothers, right?
You said that, I didn't. No, it's exactly like Smash Brothers. It's basically it's Smash Brothers, but with the Warner Brothers IP. I'm not sure. Actually, I hope the answer to this is no, but I'm not sure if anybody saw Space Jam, the new Space Jam.
No, gosh, no.
There's a really weird bit in the new Space Jam where it's got a, you know, the whole idea, it's similar to this, basically. It's like, it's all Warner Brothers IP smashed into one. And so there's a shot in the new Space Jam which has an Easter egg, which is the Droogs from A Clockwork Orange and the Nun from Ken Russell's The Devils. And they're both just showing up. And Multiversus is a bit like that. It's just this weird... okay, if the Droogs aren't in it yet, and neither are any characters from any Ken Russell films, but it does feel slightly strange because it does have Rick and Morty, like Mr. Meeseeks, up against Batman, against Superman, against someone from Adventure Time, and against someone from against Velma from Scooby-Doo. And it's just like this tasteless clash of everything. But the actual game itself was actually like surprisingly good. It feels a bit distinct from Smash Brothers in that it's got an emphasis on cooperative and team play. And so there's a lot more. So it's like 2v2 as opposed to 4v4, like a free-for-all. And there's systems that support that. And so you have proper support characters. You have a tether, which you can attach yourself to. So I guess playing with families is going to be a lot easier to play, basically, because you can team up with people. And having spent 2 hours with it, I actually quite liked it. And I'm looking forward to it, like being pushed out to some more people so I can spend some more time with it. Like it's a free-to-play mashup of Smash Brothers with lots of IP used... sometimes not in the best possible taste, but the actual game itself is quite interesting. So it was a pleasant surprise, basically.
I'm tentatively excited now.
I wouldn't go that far. But yeah.
Warner Brothers cartoons is like the best IP secretly the best IP in the universe, right? Like, they're all just complete math. Like, every Bugs Bunny cartoon, every Daffy Duck, they're just, like, the. I would put those on Voyager if I was sending a new Voyager into space.
100%, same here, but would you put Arya Stark in that world as well? Would you put a character in Game of Thrones against Bugs Bunny?
I mean, do you know what? I think part of the genius of Bugs Bunny is he would make it work. My wife's first crush, her first serious crush was Bugs Bunny, and I've always sort of loved that. Sadly, she went on to marry Daffy Duck. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Christian, what have your highlights been this week, if any?
I have to say, this is an awful answer. It's not an awful answer, it's just a very predictable answer. But Mark Van Honecker, the guy who wrote Skyfaring, one of my favourite books, and I think I wrote about it for Eurogamer a while back. He's a pilot, he's a British Airways pilot and a beautiful writer, and he wrote this wonderful book called Skyfaring about being a pilot and flying a 747 around the world. And it's just a really good book if you want to read someone talk about their job when they really love their job. It's just a really passionate book about someone who loves their job. And it happens that their job is super interesting and flying is very interesting. He's just written his second book, which came out this week. It's called Imagine a City. And I'm about halfway through it and I'm absolutely adoring it. And he was it's much more of a memoir. In the first one, you get a sense of him, but you don't learn a lot of details about him. In this one, he tells you a lot more stuff and it's extremely moving. I cannot recommend it enough. And I just come back to one thing he said in Skyfaring, which I continue to think about, is he was saying that like the thing that marks out a pilot's experience being different from other experiences, it's not that they spend so much time in the air, it's that the amount of places on the ground that they can connect meaningfully to each other is absolutely exploded, because like he knows like Delhi and he knows like Moscow, and you know, you fly to sort of Saudi Arabia and Los Angeles and it all sort of comes together. You can put all these places in the world together. And wow. The first time I read that, I thought, do you know what? That's actually similar to playing games, in that you know what it's like. You sort of slip into a memory of like, God, was that a game or was that real life? You know, especially when you go to the place, when you go to Tokyo, it's very hard not to, if you're in Shibuya, it's very hard not to be in a constant jet set radio flashback, and you turn a corner and you're like, oh my God, that thing in Jet Set Radio was actually real and here it is. And like, and that sense of being able to put all that stuff together, I think is really, I love that idea that sort of this is something we share in common with pilots, is that sense of a much expanded range of sort of places we can clip together.
I bet Bugs Bunny would write a good memoir.
Oh my God. Well, do you know what? Can I just say, there is a wonderful, I think it's called Duck Amuck. The wonderful book by Chuck Jones is really brilliant. And it's his memoir of working at Termite Terrace and all of the stuff they got up to. And it includes, I think it includes the most heartbreaking story ever, which is Warner Brothers, I will stop talking in a minute. Warner Brothers had literally the greatest comic, like their cartoons were so much better than everyone else's cartoons. And the reason you know they're better is they're still funny. They still feel so modern and contemporary. But Warner, I think it was Jack Warner or whoever ran Warner Brothers, was at a party. And someone said, oh, I like your cartoons. And Warner said, oh, yeah, we make Mickey Mouse, don't we? And they were like, no, you don't. That's Disney. And he was so annoyed that he didn't make Mickey Mouse. He went home and shut down the studio. And that's how the Warner Brothers studio allegedly originally closed. And it's just a reminder that people in charge should often not be the people in charge.
Wow. I knew you'd have an anecdote for that. As soon as I said Bugs Bunny should have written a memoir. So let's get on to some quick site news this week before we get into it.
Oh my God,
so
what does that mean?
We've opened applications for our paid work experience program for ethnic minorities that begins this summer. So please send a CV and a cover letter to workexperience@eurogamer.net if you're interested. The more applications, the better. Also, we've made a few changes to our guides team. The heroes of our website, and we've promoted Lottie Lynn to guides editor and welcomed a new writer, Jessica Orr, to the team, which is great. So let's get into the week. So the big talking point this week, which we'll go into a teeny bit of detail on, but not much because it's been discussed in detail in a newscast, is that the revamped PlayStation Plus service that's launching here next month on the 23rd of June, a little bit earlier in America, a little bit earlier, well, next week in Asia, they revealed most of the lineup that's coming with that. And it's now a bit like Games Pass, except not quite as good. Is that fair? Martin, you had some thoughts that you shared on the site this week.
It just, yeah, I think it was just the obvious point. It just felt a bit flat, basically. After, because it's been like months that there was rumours of Sony's Project Spartacus, which is quite like, it felt like quite a high-minded name for what was basically just like, here's two things we're already doing, we just smash them together, and that's literally it. And I think the expectations were probably a bit out of whack, which is, as is so often the case, is as much on us as it is on them, because of where the people who kind of are like, oh, is this going to be the Game Pass killer? Is this going to be just this incredible thing? And it turns out it's just PlayStation Now and PlayStation Plus at a new combined price point and nothing more imaginative than that. And I guess, yeah, I was hoping for a tiny bit more than that. And obviously looking at the legacy of PlayStation as well, I'd have hoped that the some of the older titles might have been treated with a bit more respect and fanfare. But maybe that's coming. The service is launching on the 24th. I think it's next week in Japan it launches. And it doesn't roll out over here until mid-June.
Yeah,
so there's time for all the snazzy stuff and for them to put a spotlight on the older games. But obviously, a lot of people point out as well, though, that people don't really pay this. People won't be subscribing for this to play Jumping Flash. that's just me.
Speak for yourself.
But there are some good games there, right?
Yeah, no, there's some fantastic stuff there as well. Obviously, the elephant in the room is the fact that games aren't coming. AAA games aren't coming day one as they do on Game Pass, and that's a big point of differentiation. And it's a bit murky because it looks like basically doing a bit of your own kind of theorizing and working back at what's enough and what's coming when. It looks like there's basically a year window until the big games hit. So something will come out of then, like a AAA game will come out, and then this is the Sony's first party stuff. And this is just extrapolating from what we've seen, basically. It's not the policy as we understand it, and Sony's not being transparent about any of this. It's just that's what it looks like from what's on offer and in terms of when stuff is hitting that service.
Well, I'm about a year behind, so that's perfect. I really want Nintendo to kind of catch up and launch something. I know they've got like a classics thing that they do.
I'm again, this is the perspective of someone who's literally surrounded by amiibos right now. But Nintendo Switch Online, actually, now it's bedded in, it's not that bad, you know.
It's got the best games, probably. I would say that, but it's got so many perfect games on it. Like, it's got Super Mario World and everything. You know, it's just...
Yeah,
sorry, cutting you off.
No, I cut you off. Sorry, I started it.
No, my hearing aids turned me into a monster, and I can now hear everything really well, and it makes me keep thinking I could dive into conversation with this sort of scalpel precision I didn't have before. But sorry, I cut you off. You were saying something much more interesting than I was.
Well, I think it's just the thing with Nintendo Switch Online is you know exactly what it is, and as in, you know exactly that it's a bit shit. But it's also only 20 quid or whatever, so it's not that bad. And for that, you get to play some Switch games online with a fairly substandard online service. But also, you get the Nintendo Switch Online apps, you get the Mega Drive one, which has got some amazing games in there. It doesn't take up, it's not that difficult to set up to download the Japanese versions as well, so you get much better cover art and it looks beautiful. The emulation handled by M2, so you know it's all really good. And just that enough, getting Mega Drive games, SNES games, N64 games, getting to play Earthbound on your Switch, that's just enough for me to basically, it's not much, but you know exactly what it is, and it's easy to communicate, basically. Whereas the Sony system is quite a lot. There's three tiers, it's all quite confusing. Some of the stuff is streamable, some of it isn't. You don't know if games are coming, when they're coming, everything. So there's a lot there, but it doesn't feel as coherent and so it's difficult to grasp in such an easy way as Nintendo Switch Online.
That started off as a really bad sales pitch, and then it got turned into a really good sales pitch.
I'll take that.
That's the trick. Yeah.
So, diving into some of the other headlines this week, the new Test Drive Unlimited game that I didn't even know existed, called Solar Crown, was delayed to 2023, and the old gen console versions were cancelled, which I guess we can kind of expect from games these days.
What's it called? Solar Crown?
Martin, is this going to be good?
No, yes, it will be. It will be, because it's being handled by, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's Keeleton doing it, who came from sort of nowhere in the mid-10s, I guess we call them, 2014, 2015, made some quite unremarkable racing games. And then got the WRC license off of Milestone. and actually did some okay things of it. I think the momentum with that series did stall in recent years, as will always happen when you get a small team trying to churn out games annually. It soon becomes apparent that maybe it's not a best fit for small teams because of the improvement every year becomes smaller and smaller. But anyway, they did do a good job with it and kind of gave Codemasters a run for their money and kind of proved themselves as actually a decent studio. And I've enjoyed the output on the racing, on the four-wheel stuff, on the two-wheel stuff as well, with the Isle of Man games. And so it's just they know what they're doing basically when it comes to automotive games. And the idea of them having almost a clean sheet of paper, well, not a clean sheet of paper because it's a sheet of paper which has been sketched on by some absolute mad lads who made the first two test drive games, which were like very a favourite of former editor-in-chief Ollie Welsh, who absolutely adores them. They are completely bonkers, like proper Euro trash games. Like imagine Forza Horizon, but like presented by Jean-Paul Gaultier and who's the other guy as well. And just with just like, yeah, which is that slightly wonky 90s Channel 4 vibe to them. Then you've got like Test Drive Unlimited.
And with the, I remember like you could basically have, you could create your own living room that looked like it, every, you could create your own house as long as it ended up looking like Tiesto's house. You know, like sort of white sort of segment sofas and stuff like that. They were so charming, those games. Is it still, are the new developers, are they French or not? Because this is important.
Yes.
Oh, okay, then it's fine. Good hands.
It'll be good. Then. Yeah. So Bohemia, who I'd sort of forgotten about, teased Armor 4, which I guess we thought was maybe in development, but it's quite nice to see that it is. That game's still got a really strong following, and they've got some Cold War military shooter called Armor Reforger, which makes me want to sing Armor Survivor, no?
And, it has. I did feel sorry for them because now is not the time to be announcing the military sim, I don't think, given the current global climate. Sorry to bring it down a bit, but also it does actually. I think we were quite kind of wary about it when we first got wind of it. Cause it's like it's a weird time to kind of play to that fantasy. But obviously, a lot of games do, and I think the Cold War setting, does it help?
It's a bit.
I don't think so, but I mean, it's interesting. You see, like even we had this thing about, because Advance Wars was meant to be out pretty much now, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm,
I was talking to one of our freelancers and just going like, just do not fancy it. Do you know what I mean? It feels very weird, and it sort of reveals perhaps how weird even the most sort of candied up of these games. There is something weird there. I think they're brilliant.
Yeah, games. But we're like. We still did that on a tangent, but I've been playing a lot of Battlefield 2042 recently, and as a sign of how glacial EA is in updating that game, you still play as Russian forces in that game, which is absolutely mind blowing to me that you actually are fighting under a Russian flag in a video game. And I would have thought that would be the first thing you'd be like, should we just address that and maybe let's not do that?
Not known for their nimbleness, are they? EA sort of
no. But back to Armor, it's hit early access, isn't it? I think on Xbox as well.
Ah, I didn't realise.
And so I think Armor's never really made much of a play for the console space. And so I think there's some interest in how it's going to shape up because it's on Xbox as an early access program. So it's on there as well.
Awesome. I also saw that Greedfall, that game that kind of came past and had nice ambitions, that's also getting a sequel, which I'm sort of surprised about, but I'm kind of happy about because it seems like that, I don't want to trash them here, but it seems like that double A kind of RPG.
That's not trashing. That's the highest praise you can. Yeah, that's the highest praise you can bestow on something.
No higher praise.
Which I love to see. And more importantly, I saw that Dead by Daylight is getting a dating sim. I think people had speculated about this game being real, and apparently it is real. So Jason Voorhees is, you know, one of the in this dating game, and it's. It looks very over the top and quite fun, actually. I think they're pandering to that audience. Let's move on. Digital Foundry this week. Here we go. This is where I pretend to understand. Digital Foundry delivered the verdict on what's better for gaming and content creation, DDR5 or DDR4 RAM? Big question. And what is... the answer is complicated, obviously. DDR5 is more capable, but for the money you spend on it, you might as well stick to DDR4 and upgrade your processor, graphics card, or storage.
Am I the only person who's hearing that as Dance Dance Revolution?
I'm hearing that as Dance Dance Revolution as well. And I'm like, I'd be the kind of person you'd send down to Curry's to say, can you get me some like DDR5 and I come back with a dance mat? It's like, because I've got you sorted, Rich. Is this what you wanted? It's like,
So the answer is instead of getting expensive DDR5, get yourself a dance mat and stick to DDR4.
Have I told you, I've told you this before, but I bored you about Gran Turismo and playing conventional games on a dance mat is one of the best things you can do. Because with Gran Turismo, you have to you steer, you like sit down in it, and you have to get your legs like straddled out like that and to accelerate like that, and then you steer with your bum. And it's really Gran Turismo is fantastic. I think the term Gran Turismo might have been something from an old edge or something, but anyway, I would highly recommend doing it. And you can play Tekken that way as well. And with the way inputs work in Tekken, to actually fight each other, you have to just kind of just stamp on the spot. Dance mats are great.
I'm glad I started talking about RAM now. Eurogamer founder Rupert Lohmann used to have a metal dance mat when we were at school, and one of those sort of like paper ones or whatever they were, plastic ones that you rolled out as well. But the metal one was really cool. Anyway. DF also took a closer look at Trek to Yomi, that kind of side-scrolling samurai game, the black and white samurai game, which looks nice but doesn't play too nice in summary. Over in video, Ian played Resident Evil Village in VR and said it's incredible, capital letters, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. He does a VR series where he plays all kinds of games in VR, they're modded VR. I suggest you check it out because obviously they look really cool when you can see these Lady Dimitrescu up close. Ian was also playing Evil Dead the game, which Christian, you've also been playing.
Yeah, I did. I played it. I didn't play it for an enormous amount of time, but I played it. I was just really interested in how I really quite like Evil Dead. I like particularly like Evil Dead 2, which I think is a really interesting, lovely movie. And actually very similar to sort of Warner Brothers. You know, I'm not particularly keen on horror, but that one, because it's so sort of Bugs Bunny-ish and sort of I know Sam Raimi's really into the Three Stooges, and it's really a Three Stooges. It's even got Three Stooges jokes in it, basically.
And this is a 4v1 game, is it?
So, yeah, that's right. So the game itself, I was just really interested in whether you could capture that particular horror series in a game, because the movies are so much like Little Big Planet almost, you know, they're really sort of, everything's really sort of cobbled together, but really sort of sophisticated, but really sort of handcrafted. All of these jokes and sort of bits of business and sort of puppets and, you know, the best bit in them is when he's trying to, his girlfriend's disembodied head has been clamped onto his hand and he's trying to get rid of it, and then her body comes into the room with like a chainsaw, and, you know, it's really, really sort of funny. I mean, maybe it doesn't sound hilarious, but when you see it, it's really funny. And I was like, oh, I don't know if a horror game can kind of capture this. And for me, it's a surprisingly sort of straightforward, quite good 4 against 1 horror game. But it's sort of dully, boringly competent. That's unfair. It's really competent, but it didn't have much of a spark for me until I played as the one against the four. So when you're the demon, you're essentially like being the director of a Evil Dead movie. So you're sort of running around this huge map and sort of planting things which are going to screw people up. And then you can possess people and sort of turn them against their teammates. And you can spawn monsters and you can play tricks on people. And it's really, you feel more like, less like Ash or anyone in the movie, and more like Sam Raimi, sort of the director putting everything together. And I thought that was really lovely. I really liked that a lot.
It sounds nice. And I was looking at Ian's footage and it looks kind of nice too. I like that they have kept that kind of comedy of the series. They've understood.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said boring and competent. I mean, like, I think you've played as a 4x1 and you're playing as the four. It's a very competent survival horror. And if you like that kind of stuff, you will really like it. But for me, it doesn't have the comedy of Evil Dead until you play as the director, essentially.
Yeah. So also in video, we had Aoife is continuing her Evil Within run. She never checked that game out and she loves horror. So do check that out if that's your cup of tea. And the whole team were playing a game called Midnight Ghost Hunt, which I've never heard of.
Oh, it's meant to be wonderful. It's meant to be absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely huge for them. Yeah.
In reviews, we had a game that we had taken our fancy, actually, a game called Soundfall. Ed Nightingale looked at that. It's a game where you kind of shoot and dodge to the beat, but there's a few games that kind of do this, Metal Hellsinger and some other games, and he didn't sound like he was overly impressed with Soundfall.
I think he really likes I think it's one of those games, it sounds like for the first 20 minutes, you're like, wow, this is amazingly great. And then I think he said to me that he's writes in his review that it just doesn't vary it enough. And because so much of music is sort of variation and improvisation. And sort of,
it's about giving you the room to express yourself as well, yeah. Which good music games do. Even like, for like reverting to type, going back to something like Res as well, which is on rails in more than one sense, in kind of how it lets you express yourself musically, but also it gives you just enough to do basically, so you can actually feel like you're conducting and it's your tune basically, as opposed to feeling like you're being, as opposed to you're having to just press the inputs to play along to their tune basically. It gives you just enough for you to have ownership of it, and that makes for a much better experience. And I think from the sounds of it, this didn't quite have that balancing act just right.
Yeah. Another game that we reviewed this week was Salt and Sacrifice. Hiran reviewed that for us. And it's much of what came before in the previous game, Salt and Sanctuary. It's kind of like a Souls-like game, but kind of side on. But it's got that kind of... It's got quite a nice art style, actually. But it's got that tough battle kind of mechanic where you're going to die and die a lot. And from the sounds of Hiran's review, it kind of overdoes that a little bit. And it's it grinds you down a little bit. In Features Land this week, we had Christian writing about The Evil Dead. And we also had you, talking of games with comedy, and we had you remembering Shadow of Mordor, brought hilarity to Middle-earth, or as I like to call it, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings Orcs, the game.
It really is. what a wonderful game it is. It was great to sort of go back to it for sort of 2 or 3 hours. It's one of those pieces I wish I had a bit longer. I wish I had a bit longer to write, and I could have been a bit more careful with it. But what an interesting, entertaining, hilarious game. I often wonder how I'd feel about those games if I was a serious Lord of the Rings person. But I just think they're extremely funny. And they have this incredible system in it where whenever you die, the world sort of is shuffled. The hierarchy of the world is shuffled around based on what you did. And, you know, you're basically, your death is promoting some orc you barely met into being some orc who's going to remember you the next time and has got slightly more powerful. So it's a weird sort of orc Tory party similar. but it's really charming. It's so charming. And for a game which is extremely derivative, it has this wonderful sense of its own identity. It's just a brilliant laugh. It's so funny. I don't know enough about Lord of the Rings to know whether it's a great Lord of the Rings game, but it's just a great orc killing game. It's fantastic.
The orcs are one.
Going back to where we start. Oh yeah, no, the orcs are the, yeah, they're the heart and soul. But yeah, going back to where we started as well, I've been trying to get that to work on Steam Deck as well this week, so I can actually, because the Steam Deck's like the best, an amazing AA machine for stuff. It's not AA, it's not, you couldn't hardly call that AA because it's a huge, big budget proposition, but yeah, it's great for games like that.
I think what's special about, I was just going to say quickly what's special about that. Is that it doesn't have a beginning or an end, really. I mean, it does. It has a cursory. It has the famous sort of press X to hug your wife when they're teaching you about killing people, which is a choice. But, like, it's just you're thrown into a middle act that just never really ends. It's all middle act, and it feels like Crackdown in that sense. It's just like you're doing the same thing over and over again, but because what you're doing is so brilliantly entertaining, it doesn't matter. Sorry, I didn't really need to cram a thought of that quality in.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, I liked the press X to hug your wife thing.
Yeah,
so I got a chance to play a game called Gibbon Beyond the Trees this week, which is a game I'd played a bit at the London Games Festival, WASD. It's a really simple game. In it, you're a gibbon that swings. It's a side-on game, and you kind of swing. You just hold the trigger down to swing, or the left trigger to run, and you just release the triggers at the right time to kind of string together some kind of momentum, a kind of flow. And there's this nice... They have those really long arms where they're kind of bicycling them around, and it has this nice kind of lolloping. You can hear the sound of like the hands grabbing the trees as they grab it, and it has this nice tempo to it. And that's a sort of instinctive thing that you try to kind of chain together, being like a video game thing. You want to go as fast as possible. You want to move as smoothly as possible. And then the game, it's a game about deforestation. But it doesn't kind of preach in writing to you. It just has this as kind of a backdrop in the game. And you notice it most when this lovely, lush, kind of towering jungle that you start in, where there's all kinds of branches to grab onto, and you can go up and down and all around really easily. They start pulling that away. The trees get chopped down and burnt down, and then there's suddenly nothing there to really grab onto, and you're kind of stumbling along, and it doesn't feel very nice. And then they start to bring things in that you can grab onto, but they're machines or they're buildings as you start sort of mingling with humanity and kind of urban scapes. And all of a sudden you're kind of swinging along trees, and they manage to tell their story that way, that you're still moving, but you're sort of adapting, and it's never quite as good as when you started. And they do things like kind of pulling away the sound to make it feel kind of dead. And it just does a nice way of getting a point across without kind of laboring that point or making it too overt. And it's only like an hour long, and it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's nice to look at. I found it very sweet and quite evocative.
There's a lovely line in your piece on it as well. I can't remember. I'm going to mangle the line, but it's like, it's harder to ignore the message, isn't it, when it's a mechanic rather than sort of a bit of storytelling. What's your actual line? Your line's so good.
Yeah, it's we can't ignore a mechanic like a story. And I thought it did a good point there, because if more games could tie the important things about their stories into mechanics, then, you know, we can't then push it aside and be like, you know, I won't interact with that then. I thought it was a really nice fundamental way to kind of get a story across. Just quickly, before we go on, we also got a look at the new Saints Row game that's coming out. We got a chance to talk to the team. Ian's also got some footage of that. It sounds like Victoria talked to the team and looked at the game for us, and it sounds like it's wild. And it's got all the customization options that you're used to, but maybe it's a bit scruffy. I think that's probably a good thing.
I think a lot of people actually quite like scruffy is good, because you don't want those games to be too polished. We'll see how it is. There's still a way to go to the release. Actually, there's not that long to go to release at all, is there? It's within the next few months.
My favourite Saints Row story is the demo of the first one, which had a cordoned off bit of the city you could run around, and it had these invisible wall. It had these visible sort of laser walls which stopped you from sort of moving out of the bounds of the demo into the actual city. But if you parked a car up against the walls and then got out the other side of the car, you could actually then go and explore the entire city. It accidentally given the entire city away, even if not all the missions and stuff. That was a nice moment.
Fantastic. That's everything from us this week. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
And thank you, Christian.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks everyone else for listening. We'll be back with more weekly. Join us then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.